Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Happy belated July 4th, everybody.
Hey, happy 4th.
I had a good 4th. I went and saw fireworks. I had a friend in an apartment that was overseeing Auditorium Shores and got to watch a pretty kick-ass fireworks show, actually.
I got to see fireworks as well, but not as probably as kick-ass as yours. Ours was just in a grassy field in front of a high school.
Yeah.
And I did have a snow cone. Snow cones are cool.
Snow cones are good. I was impressed that the city of Austin has not been doing fireworks for the past few years because of the burn ban stuff. Yeah. And so I don't know how that much that had to do with it, but they went all out this year. This was a long, impressive fireworks show, and I was like, I've seen the last most recent fireworks stuff I've seen has been like at Disney World.
Yeah.
And this was pretty impressive. So yeah.
That's a pretty nice.
We haven't done this for 5 years, we're gonna go all out.
Yeah. We've been stockpiling.
We've been stockpiling.
You know what I did?
What'd you do?
I worked.
Really?
Yeah.
That's too bad. Your boss sounds like a jerk.
He's definitely
he didn't step out back to watch the fireworks from Old Settlers.
Like, while the store was open?
Step out to look at a sunset.
Yeah, for like 2 seconds.
What, man-made artificial sunset is not good enough for you, Dave?
They had Gandalf fireworks.
It was pretty cool. All right, the rest of July, we've just got a couple things going on. We've got Gaming with Rogues. They're playing the card game Nyet, N-Y-E-T, yep. Russian for no.
Yes.
That is going to be on Saturday, July 16th. And then that next Sunday, July 17th, will be our Magic pre-release for Eldritch Moon. And our book of the month is Watchmen, which you can get 15% off on or 25% if you have a Rogue card.
Right.
And we'll be doing our Reading with Rogues in August. All right, moving on to news of the free world. There's a lot of stuff. First of all, let's talk Pacific Rim 2.
Yeah.
It sure seems to be happening.
Right? What is it that makes it more seem to be happening than it did previously?
So we have a director, Stephen S. DeKnight. We knew that.
Yep.
We have a star, John Boyega.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now we have a date.
Right. John Boyega is supposed to be the son of Idris Elba.
Yes.
Character.
Striker Eureka's
pilot. Which, by the way, is very anime.
Yeah.
You know, can you live up to your father's legacy, et cetera, et cetera.
So the date is February 23rd, 2018.
Okay.
Which I saw in the article they were talking about how February used to be sort of a dumping ground for movies,
mm-hmm.
but that the summer movie season is sort of moving a little further up.
Okay.
And as
is
example,
it 'cause it's so crowded they need
yeah.
to expand it?
The example they gave is that February 16th, 2018 is the Black Panther release date,
uh-huh.
which is clearly not something Marvel's dumping off.
No.
So it seems like February they're starting to like maybe move
That's
the summer season
yeah.
starting.
Just a different kind of approach.
So, we'll see.
Like 2 years ago, I was very hyped for this. At this point, I hope it's good.
I'm still hyped.
I also the first one is a pretty great standalone movie.
Yeah,
you know, ridiculous fun.
Yeah,
goofball fun. And so I'm like, you know, if they don't match it, is it going to be anything but a disappointment? You
it's
know,
true.
Kind of thing. But it's a good cast. The ideas sound fun. And I imagine they'll have some amazing stuff because the first one delivered in a way that a movie that thought it was going to be only one of its kind does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I won't believe it entirely until we see a trailer, but
You have a director, you have a writer, you've got a date.
We're getting there.
It's just that this one is legendarily not happening.
It's usually. It's been called off like 3 times.
Yeah.
All right,
I'm calling it off.
Oh, again? But,
yeah.
We're calling him back on.
Yeah,
Nick just called it on.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
Interesting. All right. Other movie news. Wreck-It Ralph 2 also has a date. March 9th, 2018. So we're at the point of just going ahead and calling stuff a couple years out now. I blame Marvel for that.
Yeah.
And I loved Wreck-It Ralph.
I did too.
Have you seen Wreck-It Ralph?
I quite liked Wreck-It Ralph. I don't know if I'd break out the L word.
Oh. Lesbians?
Thanks, Scott Pilgrim. one of the few criticisms I had of Wreck-It Ralph, it was like super fun movie, but was that its focus on the Candyland racetrack game is such a weirdly specific game that
it's
not like exactly a known game trope. I mean, it was also Mario Kart-ish.
Sure.
But But a sequel would allow them to maybe veer into stuff that's a little bit more anything that's not that weird.
No, the sequel is Ralph and Vanellope Hit the Internet. So it's
is that
like
the idea?
Yeah, StubHub, Google, all that kind of stuff has been mentioned. So it's somehow they wind up on the internet. So it's going to be, instead of spoofing video game tropes, they're going to spoof like internet tropes.
Really? But like video games are going to like become a diminished, if not completely gone, portion?
I think it's probably that they're coming from that world. My guess is they'll probably do some of the like World of Warcraft and that kind of stuff, and maybe bridge from there into the internet.
Right. I imagine they could have some fun if they like like, you know, some of their video game friends come with them and like get into a chat room or something like that, and you know that you can do all kinds of
Ralph and Penelope bring M. Bison along and Blanca.
But I
think that's a good thing to change that that notably.
Sure.
So. And it's still got...
That's actually notably more changeable than I would have thought it would have been.
John C. Reilly and Sarah Silverman are both confirmed to be back, so...
That's right. Sarah Silverman was the girl.
Yeah, Vanellope, who is now princess of video game land. Spoilers for Wreck-It Ralph. All right. Moving on to TV stuff. There's some interesting news here. AMC has renewed Preacher for season 2. They're going to do 13 episodes.
Right. Yeah. I think there was some unsureness about it. You know, people were liking it, but it wasn't like super crazy buzzworthy.
The ratings have been a little down, and people are not talking about it as much. It didn't help to launch during Game of Thrones, I think.
Yeah. Mm. If they waited a couple of weeks,
yeah,
they might have launched a little stronger.
I think they would have been smart to launch right after Game of Thrones because there was nothing on this Sunday. Like, Sunday's usually the big night. There's nothing for a couple of weeks. They would have owned that space.
Yeah.
So it's kind of crazy that they went, but AMC's never been that smart about what they do anyway. So, for all I know, Walking Dead's back in a week, and that's why they didn't want to do it. I'm not really up on Walking Dead anymore. But I've been liking, I'm one episode behind on Preacher, so I've seen five of them.
I'm 3 episodes behind. I'm lagging.
I caught the last couple nights, and the general criticism I've heard is that it's a little slow. And it is a little slow. I am forgiving of slow TV as long as the moments and the characters are good.
Yeah.
And this show is beautifully shot and has great casting and that kind of thing. So I'm willing to forgive them, but I do feel like somebody needs to step on the gas. So if they've got a season 2, I feel like that's an indicator that at least maybe they're going
to
get
do
going.
Do we presume that it will move to road trip territory at that point?
I assume that's where they're headed. Like, that season 1 was all about setting up Jesse and Tulip and Cassidy's backstory.
Right.
And that season 2 will be the road trip beginning.
Right, which was in some ways, all the comic ever was.
Yeah.
But it did so... I did understand their rationale to, like... Well, by the time you saw him as a preacher, he was like had kind of like given up the preacher business.
Yeah.
So a little bit of establishment was maybe a good idea. I don't know if the whole season.
I've always had pacing issues with most of AMC shows. So
even AMC's arguably best shows like Mad Men and Breaking Bad have been accused of being slow from time to time.
Yeah.
So I think that's sort of probably something that AMC does, that they tend to go a little slower. Usually I'm fine with it, but this one it is. They probably, like I say, need to step on the gas a little bit. Netflix is doing a show that we've all been waiting for, Lost in Space. And by all, I mean none of us.
You mean they're remaking the horrible Matt LeBlanc movie?
See, that's the funny thing. Like, the people, anyone who remembers Lost in Space, for the most part, are people who remember it as being a terrible movie from the 90s.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's...
That was given away with many of the DVD
people. Yeah, I had it.
People who are 40 and up might have watched reruns, or if you're old enough, watched the original show, which had a sort of camp fun to it.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. The basic idea, which is kind of like a Fantastic Four type family with a few like Dr. Doom.
Yeah, Dr. Doom basically on board.
Yeah, Dr. Doom on board. Is a fun enough idea. Even think it could be better, notably, much better as a show than it was as became as a movie.
I agree.
But I have no fondness for the original property.
Yeah.
I think it was kind of like considered like the dumb show to Star Trek smart science fiction show at the time. It was kind of the goofy family show.
Do we know anybody who's involved with this one?
I don't remember the names. There was nothing particularly impressive on the list that I saw.
But Netflix, their track record is a little checkered, but it certainly had good stuff in it.
It's pretty strong overall.
Stuff. Yeah. I'm just remembering they also, didn't they produce that, like, Adam Sandler show?
They have an Adam Sandler deal, and that is sort of the other side of it. They also did Fuller House.
Yeah.
But Netflix
They've also done Voltron and House of Cards and some amazing stuff.
Yeah. I bet that is the first time anyone's mentioned Voltron and House of Cards in the same sentence.
That's probably true.
I'm sure Kevin Spacey watches Voltron.
But y'all wouldn't deny, right? Voltron, the new Voltron is rocking.
The Voltron's great. I like Voltron better than House of Cards. So,
yeah, crossover is definitely due.
But yeah, I'm curious. I'm a little surprised at this one. I don't know where the licensing money was to pick up. Like, does Lost in Space as a brand hold anything, or would it have been better of launching a new series about a family in space that did not borrow the license?
Right.
Like, is there any use to that name?
I think it was, you know, I think the pitch, by the way, for the original one was that it would basically be the Swiss Family Robinson in space. Yeah. They call it, like, Space Family Robinson.
Yeah.
And literally, it's the Robinsons. That's the name of the family.
That's right.
I wonder if they could have...
Danger Will Robinson.
I mean, I guess you're maybe paying for a license one way or the other if you do that, whether it's...
I guess, but isn't Swiss Family Robinson probably public domain at this point?
Probably so.
See, I just think they probably been better off not using the name and the license, just going with...
How about this, Randy? Space Family.
Space Family. Everybody likes licenses. Everybody likes to have that safe cushion.
Right.
I think it does draw
attention to yourself.
I think there's enough cachet in the name that people will recognize it, and because of the name, try it out.
You don't think if they had called it "We Are in Space and We Don't Know Where We Are," it would have been as effective?
Probably not as
effective. Yeah, that's probably not as good a name. All right. One more bit of TV news, and that is that the Russo brothers, who are becoming like Lord and Miller and that they're attached to everything.
Yeah, it's just a little disconcerting because I don't want them to overextend themselves.
So far, things have worked out right.
It's true.
Are doing a Warriors TV show for Hulu.
Yeah, it's for
Russo Brothers of Cap,
Civil War,
and Civil War, and I guess some TV stuff.
Community.
Before that, yeah.
And the upcoming Infinity, or Avengers 3, or whatever you want to call the two movies.
And a bunch of other stuff. I don't know what all, but they've been announced with a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, but they're doing for Paramount Television and Hulu with writer Frank Baldwin, which I don't recognize that name.
I don't off the top of my head.
But they're attached to adapt the tale of the Warriors, which if you watch movies in the 80s, you know what the Warriors is.
Actually, I guess it was 70s. Like,
was it 70s?
Late 70s.
I think it was early 80s, but I could be wrong.
I thought it was really early 80s.
It's like, I think it's like 79 or 80.
You got to remember, late 70s, early 80s are basically the same period.
It's true.
But you know better than I. You were the biggest Warriors fan.
I'm a big Colt fan. Grew up watching it a lot.
Played the video game.
Nick is pulling it up extremely slowly. Yeah, you know, I didn't play a lot of the video game, although it did expand somewhat nicely.
So Dave is right on this one. It's 1979.
Huh. Well, that's not shocking. Dave is the biggest Warriors fan of the three of us.
I did go and see when they had, I believe maybe the first time I ever went to the Alamo Draft House.
Huh.
My brother and I were catching a, it was either that or a Phantasm one, the other cult movie of the 70s.
Yeah.
But yeah, they did a night where they had like a couple guys from the movie out, and they were just doing a screening like at midnight or whatever.
Yeah,
And people were invited to wear their colors and stuff like that. And I think there might have even been a few people, you know, with the baseball furies look and all that stuff. But anyway, yeah, a very fun cult action movie that's a little bit like the 70s gang version of like The Odyssey.
Yeah,
they. I imagine many of our listeners have seen this, sort of the honorable street gang, the Warriors.
They get framed for an assassination.
They get framed for an assassination of a guy who was trying to unite all of New York's gangs.
They kill the Martin Luther King of gangs.
That's exactly right. And then they're stuck in their home territory is Coney Island, and they have to try and make their way back from like the Bronx to Coney Island with basically every gang in the city looking to get them. Now, how you translate that, because that is like it's a one-movie adventure, essentially.
Yeah.
But depending on where they go with it, it was always a very sort of stylized world.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed like sometimes the city seemed almost empty, and these gangs had weird themes and stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, in a weird way, it's such a... The movie is so perfect at being itself that I feel like that you shouldn't ever remake it, expand on it, or anything like that. But if anybody was going to do it right, I feel like these are the guys.
Yeah.
It seems like they're going to direct the pilot, but no word beyond that who else is going to...
So someone else will show run,
Yeah.
That's probably smart. But here's my question. Do we know if it's going to be a period piece?
That's a good question. I've incidentally sometimes heard, although I don't know if I believe this. It is based on a book, but I've sometimes heard it described as like a as near future. You know, as if it's some it was supposed to be a 70s vision of a bleak, you know, kind of like very urban near future New York.
That makes sense because in the 70s it looked like New York was just going to hell.
Right.
We all thought Escape from New York was its inevitable future.
Right. And they're just like we're like, well, what if in the future people gangs might dress as mimes?
The thing is now. That is a terrifying future. The thing is, now I don't see New York going that way. It's more like it'll wind up underwater, which would be a different version of the story, too. But I don't know if they can do a – I feel like if it's not a period piece, it's going to be hard to sell. Like, they can't have trouble with, like, the hipster gangs of Starbucks in Times Square, you know?
Right. Well, I do think that the Russo brothers seem to have a fondness for, like, I would say 70s-era stuff, whether it's – what is it? 3 Days of the Condor?
Yeah.
They're calling out, like, in that, they called out, like, Marvin Gaye's album.
Yeah.
So, I think they kind of like a little bit of period.
Yeah.
That's an era that they have a fondness for.
Yeah. So, maybe they'll do a period piece.
Yeah, it could be a period piece.
I mean, I guess what you do is kind of what Warriors originally was, which is a sort of an almost alt-70s.
Right.
Where that was, like, that's what it was like.
It could also be an alt-2000s.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, with sort of a fallen New York, I don't know. I'm not sure what they're going to do.
I'm curious, and I could absolutely see a TV version of this working. I don't know about multiple seasons.
Even within the span of the movie, there was, like, sort of politics within the gang and rivalries and attempts to from one member to sort of dethrone the others and all that.
Yeah.
And there was the, in their stylized world, it's like the gang politics were actually kind of interesting.
Well, that's what I wonder, is maybe they will take a more of a Sons of Anarchy approach where it's not all about their race to get home,
right.
but about the sort of machinations between the gang and and that kind of thing, a little deeper.
Hypothetically, all these gangs have interesting stories behind them. You see a little bit of that in the movie, but presumably just the loss of Cyrus, the leader of the Riffs that are like the mega gang that are going to unite them, you know, even if they lose Cyrus or whatever in, you know, what might be the first season or the first few episodes or whatever, they'd still be the most powerful gang in the city.
Yeah.
There could be all kinds of... you know, I think the Sons of Anarchy thing is probably a good point, Randy, that sort of jockeying for position between rival gangs.
Yeah.
But also, there'll be, like, more personal stories, there'll be more action-adventure-oriented moments. I could see it working.
All right, final story here. The Marvel Now teasers are going out. First of all, I want to talk about this Marvel Now thing.
I barely even know. It's just their new initiative.
So
right?
Marvel Now seems to be what they do as a every. But what it means is it's the latest iteration of new first issues or new series or post event, and they've done it like 4 or 5 times now. I like this. I love this regeneration of the product line every 6 or 8 months.
Yeah, right.
I know some people hate it. Some people do not like a refreshing, a bunch of new number ones, but that's
it's
the market we're in.
It's more of like just a way of branding the kind of standard moment of a refresher that happens kind of anyway. Every few years, there's going to be kind of a new attempt to inject some new life into the line, bring on some new writers, new directions.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just call it Marvel Now.
Yeah.
There's always going to be, in a few years, another Marvel Now.
All it is branding something that's been going in comics forever, which is the old order changes in the Avengers, of Defenders Time for Renewal.
Right.
Or Renewal. you know, when you bring on a new writer, like, they're just putting a branding on it. It's modern-day marketing for what has always gone on in comics.
Right.
So...
Yeah, the Avengers old order changes thing is a good example. I don't know that, like, I mean, when I started reading Avengers as a kid, I don't think that team stayed the same for more than a year, tops.
No.
The evolution is built into it, and this is just that for the whole line.
And, like, giant-sized X-Men and all this kind of thing. Yeah. Marvel's always been about shaking things up.
Yep.
Spider-Man throwing his costume in the trash can, all that kind of stuff. That's always been a part of Marvel.
Don't do it, Spidey.
And I feel like some people see it as outwardly driven marketing.
Right.
And I feel like instead it's marketing taking a cue from what they do, which is every now and then you do a big story, you launch a bunch of stuff out of it.
Like, you think maybe like a reader cynicism is being overly critical on this one.
I think so. I'm always excited by these little teases. I always want to know what's coming next.
Right. Yeah, it's essentially an opportunity for them to kind of amp up their PR and promotions and stuff like that and say, hey, here's some stuff to, you know, get excited about.
And there's also the fun thing where we all get to speculate.
Yep.
And so that's what we're going to do right now.
Indeed, there is a poster.
There is a new image, and I'll try and remember to link this in the show notes, but it's on Comic Book Resources, among other places. It's Marvel Now, Fall 2016, and it says Divided We Stand. And it is done by Mike Deodato. And on the left side, we've got a big giant talon that might be Fin Fang Foom.
Well, before you actually get into the specifics, it's a big group shot.
It's a big group shot.
There's lots of heroes and characters in this. It's like they're new versions. And that's where all the speculation is. Like, who is that person on some of these?
So in the background, you've got a giant foot that might be Fin Fang Foom or American Kaiju from New Avengers.
Interesting.
Front and center, you've got Dr. Doom holding the new good-looking Hugh Jackman-esque a little bit. Dr. Doom?
Yep. So Secret Wars series?
He came back unscarred, and he's like, Tony Stark's, I don't know, Nick, you've been reading it. He's like his ally, or is he like rival?
Tony doesn't trust him, but he's more of he's trying to do good, but no one trusts him because he's Dr. Doom.
Does he have an immediate goal, Nick? Like, I'm trying to do the X?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, just curious.
But he is holding Iron Man's helmet in the palm of his hand.
Yep.
Behind him, we've got Captain America, Captain Marvel, Maria Hill, Elektra, Jessica Jones, the Ultimate Thor, Black Panther, Cable, Gamora, Slapstick, Solo, and a new Fool Killer.
That new Fool Killer is weird. Also, Ultimate Thor has not been around, right?
He survived, though. He survived Secret Wars.
He escaped Secret Wars.
Nick knew this, and I did not, but apparently, yeah.
Where has he been?
This will be his first show.
And on the other side, front and center, we've got a new African-American woman who is part of Iron Man's crew.
Yeah, she's shown up
the issue I randomly read and recommended some months ago had her, I think, kind of introduced her in it.
Yep.
And she is wearing what looks like a sort of more modern War Machine armor.
That's the armor she created.
Okay.
She is
front and center. And then in the back, we've got Gwenpool, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, America Chavez, Moon Girl, Prowler, the new Wasp, the new character who I believe is, I can't remember his name, but he's a character who's an Inhuman who can sort of transfer into other people's bodies. Miles Morales, the Hulk looking much more old school Hulk, not totally awesome. Kate Bishop, Hawkeye, Miss Marvel, and Doctor Strange. Now, what I think these teasers are like big indicators of either new books being launched or shakeups in the creative teams, that kind of thing.
Right. At the very least, we would expect that these are characters who are going to get spotlights.
So, you know? I am guessing that Slapstick is there representing Deadpool Marks for Money, which we know is getting into number one.
Well, also Solo and Fool Killer. They're part of it.
So that's Deadpool Marks for Money.
Randy, which one is Fool Killer?
Fool Killer is this one. It's not a great design.
Okay, then who's the lady right there?
That is Jessica Jones.
Oh, okay. That's why she looks like just a normal person.
Yeah. Jessica Jones we know is getting a new series because Bendis is coming back to write her again. Uh-huh. I'm guessing there's a new S.H.I.E.L.D. That's what Maria Hill's doing in there. Or maybe she's part of the new USA Avengers, which is what American Kaiju is probably part of. I wonder if Elektra's getting a new series. Because Elektra hasn't had a series in a little while, and I could see them trying to trade off the Daredevil fame a little bit.
Yeah. She had one not too long ago. It's the Mike Del Mundo.
Yeah. But it only ran for a short time.
Sure.
I wonder if... Wasn't Gamora getting a solo series? Didn't we hear about that a long time back?
It was supposed to be from the writer of Guardians of the Galaxy.
I think that might finally be going through.
That's interesting.
I don't know what Ultimate Thor is doing in there. I'm curious. I assume both captains are there just to represent the books that's getting sort of refreshed after Civil War.
Right.
And then Cable, it would make sense for Cable to get a series since they're talking about him for Deadpool 2.
Right.
And it's probably time for him to come back. I know he's an Uncanny Avengers, but to come to prominence a little bit. Gwenpool, I assume, is just because she's new. Unbeatable Squirrel Girl and America Chavez, I know, are part of USA Avengers. We know that Miss Marvel is...
Just a real quick aside, Randy. Who was it? Anna Kendrick? This is kind of making the rounds, like, trending on Facebook and stuff, that she wanted to play Unbeatable Squirrel Girl.
Yep.
Now, I'm guessing probably not going to happen if even a Squirrel Girl movie is even remotely in the works.
I love Anna Kendrick. I don't think she's...
It's not the craziest thing in the world, though. And it is interesting. To me, I was just more amused by the fact that sort of like an A-list actress like that would say, that's who I want to play.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just that's an interesting sign of the world we're living in.
All right. I have a question for both of you guys. This has been driving me crazy. During our All Ages Awesomeness, Joe Quinones and I think Babs and maybe Jesse Jordan were talking about who would be perfect casting for Squirrel Girl. And they had someone, and I can't remember who it was.
It was
Mae Whitman. Thank you.
Who dat?
Mae Whitman is in Arrested Development. She's Anne.
Yeah.
She was Roxy in Scott Pilgrim.
Yep.
Okay.
She's perfect. And I knew there was someone who was perfect. I couldn't remember who it was. That's who it was. We know that the kids are becoming a new champions team, that and like that's Miles Morales, Miss Marvel, the Wasp, all those guys. I think the Hulk is probably the biggest tease here.
By the way, that but I think did we talk about the champions team at all? Because the interesting thing about that, from what I read, is that they seem to be almost like they. I think they described them as like an activist team, which I thought might be kind of an interesting approach.
But it's Mark Waid, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That'll be interesting. You think that's Amadeus as Hulk?
I do.
Really? Because it doesn't look like him. Of course, this is Deodato drawing, and he doesn't really do the goofy so much. So, but I think the other main, the other really interesting thing is the two lead characters, Doom and the girl whose name I do not know.
Right. And, War Machine and, 2.0 or whatever she ends up being.
And Tony Stark is not here.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's telling.
Yeah.
So.
Certainly
Randy has a theory.
I have
certainly
a theory.
Marvel would be. The speculation about that was what they wanted. It's like, oh, that means he's going to die in Secret Wars 2.
I have a different theory. But.
Yeah.
Anything, we'll see. Anything fit for air?
We'll see. No, because we don't want to spoil anything. No. But we will see next week which one of us is right and which one of us is dead.
It's true. We shall. I'll be right.
All right. Any other thoughts on this?
And by the way, just for our people who are wondering, what's the magic thing that's next week? The new issue of Civil War is supposed to have something big in it, right?
Yeah.
Whatever. We don't know what's going on, but there's a good chance that somebody might get offed or something.
Yep.
Big things will be afoot, so check that out.
All right. Any other thoughts about this teaser before we move on?
No, I think you covered it.
Looks interesting.
All right. That's us. That's it for news this week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, July 6th. Nick, I'm going to start with you.
Really?
Yeah, okay. I've got a lot to talk about this week because first week is my favorite week, and so many of my favorite books came out this month.
Well, and honestly, we didn't have a ton of time to read. So
it was such a puffy week.
I did not get a chance to read some of the ones I've been wanting to, but I did get to read a lot. So I was very happy with Green Arrow number 2. This is Ben Percy, Otto Schmidt. Yep. It's sort of continuing the tale of Ollie after sort of the big
something looked bad, like something really bad appeared to have happened to him at the previous
issue. And I remember hearing Otto Schmidt in an interview basically say he wants to not rebuild Ollie, but sort of put him in a bad place.
Uh-huh.
And he definitely is in that bad place rough at this spot. Point. But he's it's also kind of cool to see this all the other members of what is Green Arrow's team kind of emerge.
Right.
Because this issue not only does a lot of Black Canary, which I really like the design that Otto Schmidt gives her, and I like the canary on her back.
Mm-hmm. It's more the artist, right?
Otto
Schmidt is the artist.
Oh, yeah, okay. Otto Schmidt. Ben Percy is the writer.
Gotcha.
And this also introduces a computer guy, which I kind of feel like he's been around maybe a little bit.
He brought it, but didn't Percy bring him in at the end of his run? At the end of his pre-rebirth run? Yeah.
Yeah. Had we not seen this guy a little bit?
Yeah, he's been in. He's been
in the first issue.
And then there's also John Diggle.
Do you feel like that dude is the male Felicity, basically?
Yes.
The guy, because like they didn't want to bring in Felicity because they don't want to screw up the Black Canary Green Arrow romance.
Right. Correct. And also, in the comics, they have a rather overt Oracle.
Yeah.
whereas in the TV show, there's not really.
Yeah.
Right. And the John Diggle stuff I thought was interesting. It's an interesting take on the character.
Yeah, I like their take on Diggle.
He's kind of just shooting a big shotgun at trying to get somebody out of a bad spot. But it's fun. And
it looks like he's working as like some sort of private contractor, mercenary, or whatever overseas.
Right. Not truly a fan of Oliver Queen's, as it turns out. Everybody who's in this has sort of their own thing that they're doing, and I kind of like that it's all surrounding Ollie, and working them together, it's the same problem that they're all going to find each other. But I really just like Ben Percy's take on Oliver Queen. It feels more right than it has in a long time. And I am enjoying seeing him going up against this kind of Court of Owls on a much larger scale.
Right.
Conspiracy. They have this giant ship thing that it looks just terrifying.
That's like an ocean-going thing, not like a spaceship, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it is an ocean-going ship, but...
Yep.
And then there's...
Am I right, Nick? This struck me as very much a particularly a rebuilding issue.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Like they wanted to maybe jettison some things and focus and zero in on some new.
Yeah, and then there's just a lot of fun little nods here. I like the stuff dealing with Ollie's, I guess, not his daughter, but sort of...
Adopted. Yeah.
It's another one of those wards.
Yeah. Sort
of, and it's Shadow's kid, too, right?
I think so.
And there's some definitely things going on there. I'm just liking this. It feels more of what I want out of Green Arrow.
Nice to finally get a Green Arrow who feels Green Arrow-y.
Exactly. So, yeah. No, it just continues to be good for me.
Dave, what about you?
I am, I believe, going possibly 4 for 4 on recommending the DC Hanna-Barbera stuff.
You're a Hanna-Barbera whore.
I am.
You're going back to the Stone Age, if I'm not mistaken.
I am. The Flintstones, indeed. This is the first issue of the Flintstones. In some ways, they're maybe most faithful one, although I guess the Future Quest is more faithful as far as, like, it only seems like a slightly tweaked version of it.
Yeah.
But this is pretty close to the original Flintstones concept, if a little...
It's close, but it's a little more serious. I mean, there's definitely some barbs right. thrown and
yeah,
stuff.
Weirdly, there are a few serious moments, which I'll get to in a second. But it's also funny. It's very funny.
Oh, yeah, it's very funny.
And it does all the traditional Flintstones stuff, which is essentially, it's modern times lensed through a humorous prehistoric take.
Right.
It begins actually at a museum in present day. And there's this, like, caveman wearing, like, a wolf cowl sort of thing. And he, like, looks like he's like, on exhibit there.
Yeah.
And they're saying, you know, that he's, you know, a popular exhibit, has all these visitors. And they're talking about how tough his life must have been then. And then you flip the page, and it's, like, cuts back to 100,000 years ago. And it's, like, the full bedrock city with, like, a jumping, you know, cars driving around, millions of shops and stuff like that.
I love the cityscape and sort of the little nods in
there. It's a great first one. And, there is indeed signs everywhere.
Yeah, and a lot of ways this feels kind of like what Chew does. Nods in the background.
Yeah.
And little jokes and gimmicks.
Yeah, definitely so. And in this, so Fred is still sort of our lead character, although we've got the others. Fred's boss is like a particularly sort of skeevy dude, businessman.
Yeah, Slate.
Slate-Rod? Or is it just... No, Mr. Slate.
Yeah, Mr. Slate.
He's got Fred training, like, new guys who are, like...
A couple of Cro-Mags.
Cro-Magnons, yeah, who... I think he says...
They're Neanderthals.
They're Neanderthals. He says, like, he's like, they're great, Fred. He's like, they don't have any concept of money yet or something like that. He's like, but he's like, I need you to show them around, take them out for a night on the town and have a good time, and, you know, get them happy with the company. And Fred is interesting. He's kind of a little bit of a company guy at first, like a nice guy, but he's aware that they're sort of being exploited.
yeah, a little bit. I feel like he's kind of a toned down version of the cartoon one. I mean, there's a little bit more to him. I don't feel like he's as brash in a lot of ways.
Right. I have not just to
he's
read
basically
this.
Like Ralph Cramden on the cartoon. He was just like prehistoric Ralph Cramden from the Honeymooners.
That's what I was going to ask. I have not a chance to read this yet, but the cartoon was very much based on the Honeymooners. Like he was Ralph Cramden. Right. And that is a very 70s thing. So reinterpreting today's modern through Stonehenge, how different is that? Is the Honeymooners thing still there?
Not really. If anything, I mean, I don't know if I have his character fully pinned down yet, but one interesting thing they've added, he's actually an ex-military guy.
Well, that's weird.
Which is weird. It seems like, in fact, he goes to like, they sort of make a joke about it that, I don't know if it would be considered tasteless. Like they go to like a veterans meeting or whatever at some point, and you see somebody has like a sort of a flashback, and he's like talking about like some sort of war crime or something, but it's lensed through crazy Flintstones stuff.
That's so weird.
It is weird. It's not as dark as it sounds because it's very comically over the top.
Okay,
but I would say it is directed at slightly more adult sensibilities.
They are veterans of the Paleolithic Wars.
Yes. Wilma is trying out painting as like a hobby, and she's doing the handprint paintings that are, you know, we've famously seen on caves.
Yep.
And it's funny, I don't know. that's right. It's some of the animals talking while she's on the phone. One of the animals, because the animals did talk, right?
Yeah,
they would say like wry observations.
Yeah,
one of them is like looking at it and he's like, "What do you think it means?" And this like prehistoric kangaroo looking dude is like, "I think it's more about the absence of meaning." But anyway, Nick, how would you describe the tone? Because it's a little anarchic. It's a little hard to describe.
Yeah.
It's not, like, heartwarming, but there are heartwarming moments in it.
It's more of, like, I would call it a down-to-earth kind of Flintstones, because it is sort of about...
Like, and he's, like, supportive. He's very supportive of Wilma doing her painting thing.
He doesn't understand it.
Right. There's a little Homer Simpson to him.
Does this reference sort of Modern Family comedies? Not, like, Modern Family, but, like... Like the CBS Family comedies, is it maybe riffing on that in the same way that the old one riffed on the Honeymooners?
Maybe a little bit. I mean, there's definitely...
Like, is it the dumb schlub guy and the hot wife? Because that seems to be a trope of sitcoms.
They're actually not doing that as much with this. And also, he actually seems a little bit less kind of pudgy than he traditionally is.
He's definitely more toned out.
Yeah, he feels like he's like a big guy, but he's not fat guy.
But the notion of sort of a kind of... comedy on like a sitcom is not too far off. A realized sitcom of the Flintstones.
Well, the art looks great.
Yeah, Steve, I don't know how you say his name, Pugh,
Pugish.
Pugay. I'm going to say C. Pugh. Is really good. It spoofs kind of the art world, among other things. It spoofs cell phones. They have the shell phones.
It spoofs our society.
There's a dude who's vaping in this. And so it is definitely a... See, Randy, there's the flashback.
Okay, right sure. There. Yep.
It's also spoofing the sort of corporate culture a little bit through the boss and his... Mm-hmm. You know, he, like, pumps iron while they're, like, people are talking to him. He definitely thinks he's kind of like... hot stuff.
It reminds me of like J.K. Simmons as Mr. Slate.
Yes, that's a good call, Nick.
So,
but there's a lot of slapstick in it too, and the verbal humor that the pun humor sort of that they did on the show.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can quite pin down in an easy elevator pitch what this is, other than a sort of modern version of the Flintstones.
So is this is one of the weirder ones they've done? I guess it's not weirder than Scooby Apocalypse. That's a pretty weird one. But it is, it's unusual.
You know, as I'm looking towards the end, it is a little sweet, though.
It is.
The stuff with Fred and Wilma is actually kind of touching.
What I also feel is, and I don't know if this is actually true, but it feels like each issue is like a done in one.
This one certainly is, and it even returns in the end to the framing device of the caveman with now sort of context filled in on what his deal was.
If they did that, it would be a nice little mirror of the actual show because they didn't really
episodic
have...
Episodic stuff.
Yeah, it's very episodic.
I bet they probably will and probably move along some major plot slightly.
So do we see Barney and Betty and...
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
The only one we're missing is Dino.
I was wondering if Dino was in there.
Dino did
and also,
not show
like,
up.
They didn't show the kids, right?
Pebbles and Bam Bam?
No, I did not see Pebbles
in fact,
and Bam Bam.
In fact, for all I know, they're going to do a storyline in which she gets pregnant and they have the kids.
I don't know. It looks like Pebbles is on the cover. I guess this covers might not be represented.
Oh, yep. You're right.
Yeah, like I think they might
Pebbles.
Be teenagers and sort of
maybe
away
just
from home a little bit.
They didn't want to overcrowd it with characters in the first one since they needed to do
okay.
the boss. Anyway, it's worth another one of these Hanna-Barbera ones. Worth a look.
I agree.
All right. I am going as far afield as possible on my pick. This is a completely original new series, Kim and Kim. It's a Black Mask.
But we were just talking about a lot last week.
Last week with Jade Street Production Services, which I really liked, and a lot of us really liked. It was mine and Tila's pick, and I liked, and so Tila, we both liked Kim and Kim better.
Whoa.
It's really good. In a week that sees Bounty, which I'll talk about a little later, which is definitely the follow-up to Rat Queens by Curtis Wiebe.
Yeah.
And it is sort of intergalactic bounty hunters in a lot of the same way that Kim and Kim is. I like Kim Kim a little bit better. I like Bounty, and I'll talk about that, but Kim and Kim is kind of what you wanted. If you're a little disappointed about the fall of Rat Queens and wondering where you're going to get that vibe again, you're going to get it in Kim and Kim.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great. They are a pair of bounty hunters, and they basically are on the outs. Her dad, one of the characters' dads, is a big wig in the bounty hunting business. They've broken off from him. They've got their, not their exes, but a couple of guys who are like their rivals who they wind up sort of having to work with. There's poaching. There are shape-shifting octopi dealing drugs. There are space tractors.
Randy, I'm also going to say, like this has the same, carries the same sort of R rating, I would say, that Rat Queens did.
Oh, absolutely.
And that to reference that briefly, even though this is not related to, but, you know, hard R, at least swearing-wise and all that. So these characters, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, R-rated humor.
Yes. It's also very queer-friendly in that the lead character sort of is queer, and the other lead character is trans, and this is written by a trans woman.
Oh, I did not know that.
Mags Visaggio, and the art by Eva Cabrera and colors by Claudia Aguirre is so good. It reminds me of what I loved about Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
But it's also got, it's got this really clean style. The action sequences where they're like beating up on their rivals with guitars and gunplay and crowbars, really fun stuff. There's lots of nice little background details.
That in particular reminded me a lot of Scott Pilgrim. Yeah. Sort of the fighting.
It's a really great first issue. I loved this book, and I cannot wait to see more of it. And it also has the benefit of a little teaser for Jade Street in the back, and a teaser for their next book, Tomorrow's Ashes. So Black Mask is definitely someone to watch.
We talked about this last week, that generally if you are an image person, you probably need to be looking into these books.
Yeah, this was so good, and I just really, really dug the first issue. Nick, what is your backup pick?
My backup pick is another DC book, and that is Superman number 2. Again, this is Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason.
You followed their whole run on Batman
and Robin, and Robin Son of Batman.
And a lot of people know the sort of tone he strikes from that, and you know that he kind of was all about bringing sort of some character to it. You know, he did a lot of evolution of Damian.
Yeah, it was all sort of the father and son relationship between those two. And
it's interesting you say that.
And that is actually sort of the same approach he's taking here with Clark and his son Jonathan.
Right.
And sort of allowing to sort of show the ropes of what it is to be a superhero a bit in this issue.
I'm just going to say what he does at the beginning, which is kind of neat. Does his son fly? I don't even know if his son can fly yet. But he takes him to show him. He's like, "Watch, I'm going to do a rescue operation."
Yeah.
Like it's a ship or a submarine or something.
Yeah, it's a nuclear submarine.
Yep, and he says like, you know, like the world doesn't know about you, so you stay hidden over here. Watch me do my stuff. Learn, you know, I'll show you the ropes.
Yep.
And I was like, that's a cool idea.
Yeah, and of course, you know, something else occurs in that.
Right.
More action. So there's a bit of action in this. But it is sort of focused on sort of that relationship and sort of the relationship. Whereas Batman and Robin was all about the father and son relationship, this one is all about the family relationship between Lois, Clark, and Jonathan and sort of how those pair, I mean, and sort of the Clark's ability to kind of raise a son in a way that Jonathan Kent, his father, couldn't. Because he didn't really know about like what Clark could do and what his powers.
Well, he'd never done it.
Right.
Clark knows exactly what it's like growing up with these powers.
Yeah, and that's sort of the juxtaposition and things that he could do.
And the nice thing is, like, family superhero stuff could easily be really boring, but they really spice it up nicely with the superhero action stuff.
Yeah, and this is the first time we see Jonathan Kent sort of break out a superhero suit in a sort of way, which is fun. And there's also just a fun sort of callback to a villain that haven't seen since the 90s, I would say. And I want to talk about Gleason's artwork.
Yeah, Gleason's art with Mick Gray's inks
is beautiful.
So good.
There's splash pages in here that are just gorgeous.
Well, Mick Gray he was the inker on J.H. Williams early on.
Was he?
And you can see a lot of that sort of inky darkness, and there's a lot of depth to this. It is just really beautiful artwork.
Yeah. No, I'm really enjoying it. I'm glad to have a Superman book that I enjoy.
Yeah.
So.
And a Superman who feels like Superman?
Yeah, Superman that feels like Superman.
How are you generally liking the kid?
I mean, I like him. I mean, he's kind of reminds me of Superman in some ways, but a little bit of Damian and sort of the brashness.
Untempered.
Yeah. And I think that's a good way to do it, especially, I'll be curious to see how those two characters interact in their book, Super Sons.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that one coming up.
Dave, what's your backup?
Backup? It's all Hanna-Barbera all the time.
Uh-huh.
Future Quest number 2. I don't have a ton to say about this because it's sort of like a more good action-adventure outing.
Yeah.
But what I will say that, like, character-wise, so what you're going to get in this one that was not in the first one is the Herculoids. Mm-hmm. And some very cool stuff with them and Space Ghost in a sort of a big opening action sequence. There's also and there are some of the characters from the ones that are from the, like, the really different worlds. Like, it was in the first one we saw, what, Birdman and, like, the quests and stuff crossing paths.
Yeah.
But we hadn't seen, like, anything exotic, like some of the Hanna-Barbera space people in a meet. But here, Johnny and Haji, they meet, Jan from Space Coast.
Yep.
And actually really, what's the name of the monkey?
Gleek, isn't it?
It is. I think it is Gleek, although I think that's...
Is that Super Friends?
I think Gleek is a Super Friends monkey, but he's a space monkey.
He's a space monkey, yeah. There's a fun scene with his arrival, and, you know, they kind of bond with them, and they are taking care of a injured Jan in this, but it looks like she's going to get some spotlight time, and I think that's kind of cool because as cool as Space Ghost is, I'd be interested to see what Jeff Parker's going to do with, you know, essentially his sidekicks.
Wait, is it Jaina? I think it would be Jason Jaina.
No, it's Jason Jan.
Yeah, it's Jan, okay. Definitely.
All right.
Yeah, I looked it up. but also Race Bannon beats up dudes and shoots dudes in black body suits. You know they're bad guys. They're all sinister looking, and they have guns and red goggles. That's definitely evil.
Yeah, definitely bad guys.
You get to see space ghosting powers at work.
Yep.
Johnny and Haji get to experience that. Birdman gets some cool stuff.
That is a sentence no one's ever said before.
And yet there it is. So anyway, this is a lot of the much more intersection of some of the big heroes in this, as well as some reveals about who about bad guy stuff going on. So, you know, to me, this is like kind of a quintessential adventure comic. It's as classically awesome adventure comic as you're going to get if you like pulp adventure and stuff like that. And like the best pulp adventure, like the old Alex Raymond's Flash Gordon and stuff like that, or even a little bit like Darwin Cook's New Frontier, the art's amazing. Evan Shaner continues to shine on this one. You know, you need to see him drawing the Herculoids. When he draws like Race Bannon kicking butt, it looks like classic action adventure.
Yep.
You will have to detach your mind a little bit from the part of you that watches Venture Brothers because there is no hint of irony or goofing on them or satire or anything like that. Nope. This is like the real deal. Anyway, so that's me. I'm old school this week.
All right. This was my – all my favorite books came out this week. So my secondary pick is actually a five-way tie.
Whoa.
But
what?
But oh, that was cheating. Super cheating. So I had to give the slight edge to the fix number four, which I think I don't know if I picked every issue of this book, but I have really loved this book. It easily could have been my pick every week it comes out. The Fix is such a great book. I have a lot of friends who read comics more casually, like they read a handful of books or whatever, and at least three of them have said, "Are you reading The Fix?" Like, this is the book that people are loving, and if you're not reading it, you really should, because it's, you know, you can describe it as sort of Shane Black or that kind of thing, but it really, that doesn't fully get what it is. It is Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber doing the craziest corrupt cops, goofy, violent, strange book, and
I see why Shane Black is the shorthand.
Sure.
Because if you've seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and stuff like that, you understand how that can go from like almost ridiculously hilarious to serious or violent.
Yep.
in a heartbeat.
So we're joining them at this point where one of the two corrupt cops have managed to get as part of a scheme. They've got one of the guys is now partnered with Pretzels, the award winning crime dog, who is just not getting along with him. We meet his girlfriend, who there's some really fun stuff with that. Then we go and we see a little bit more of his crime boss, who is hilariously sort of touchy-feely, always talking about his diet. He gives him a lunch bag and he says, "Just some quinoa with organic peaches and homemade yogurt. When you sent over your meal tracker, I was disturbed by the lack of fiber. You need it, Mac." And stuff like that, whereas at the same time, you will see him doing horrific things. And basically, this is all about the guy bonding with the dog. They also introduce a new bad guy who is a hilariously well-mannered individual. We get to see him be sort of a badass. It is beautifully drawn by Steve Lieber, of course. And this is just, it's such a fun, out there book. If you have any fondness for something like Archer, that kind of thing, I would definitely recommend you try out The Fix. And we have, as of this week, all four issues, because we've got one and two still, and we got a reprint of number three.
Nice.
So you can go try it out.
People can binge it.
Yes. Also on my stack this week, and again, these are all my favorites, there's another issue of Sam Wilson, Captain America. Again, Nick Spencer with Daniel Acuna doing great stuff. Sam Wilson having to face a question a lot of people are facing in Marvel books this week, which is, which side of the Civil War are you on? And he brings in another Captain America supporting character from Mark Gruenwald's era, who people will be very happy to see, and does it in a great way. And also, he's got the stuff in the crime with Rage and the AmeriCops and doing sort of street crime and Black Lives Matter stuff, which Spencer's been doing throughout. Just really, really good. Spider-Woman number 9. Again, Captain Marvel is her best friend. Jess wants nothing to do with this whole thing, but she is being bugged by Captain Marvel to pick a side. And the place she's being bugged is a Canadian ski lodge where they've been having trouble with Wendigos.
Nice.
So she's on a detective case with that. And the twist as to why there are so many Wendigos cracked me the hell up. Also, continues beautiful art by Javier Rodriguez. I love that book. I've expressed how much I love that book. Amazing Spider-Man 15 wraps up the Iron Man, Spider-Man, what's the guy's name? Regent story that's been going on with a guest starring of Mary Jane in the Iron Spider armor, which is not a spoiler because that's on the cover.
So I have to say, by the way, one of the nicer Alex Ross covers.
Yeah.
I felt that some of the last few have been a little bit samey, but this one I liked a lot.
Oh, I didn't know that was Alex Ross.
Yeah.
But you're right, it is. And then Moon Knight number 4, which continues along the I'm not sure what's happening 4 issues in, but I still love it. Beautiful art by Greg Smallwood. And I feel like next issue is probably going to get the answer to what exactly has been going on here.
Next issue will be about at trade paperback collection
point. All right. New number ones this week. I wanted to mention a couple. Bounty number 1 I mentioned earlier is Curtis Wiebe along with artist Mindy Lee, a couple of badass foul-mouthed female bounty hunters in space. For the Rat Queens fans, you might want to check that one out.
It also has some really nice artwork, I noticed.
Yeah. Girl Over Paris, which is a story of a girl going to a circus in Paris to do some wire walking, and it's very much sort of a character-driven book. This is notable because it's coming out from a company, Jet City Comics, who have mostly done the collections of the Hedge Knight books. They're the ones who recently have that. It's a story by Gwenda Bond, who I'm guessing is probably a mainstream writer because this whole line seems to be sort of a young adult novelists.
Uh-huh.
It's her concept, but it's written by Kate Leth. Art by Ming Doyle. So it's a pretty much all-female creative team. The colors are by Andrew Dollhouse, but the writers and the artists are all women, and it's a sort of a female-driven book.
Is that contemporary times?
It is in modern times.
Okay, just curious.
And it seems to involve ghosts here at the end. So
nice.
Interesting. And then Civil War II Kingpin number 1, which has got you your grim and gritty Kingpin as he finds a... someone who can help him deal with this new heroes can see what they're doing before they do it. And this is by Matthew Rosenberg, who's done some writing for Black Mask. This is his first Marvel thing. It's got some interesting art that I think, Dave, how'd you describe this artist? It was sort of a...
It reminded me on one level of the... I can't say...
Guy Davis.
Guy Davis. And on another of... From Punk Rock Jesus and stuff.
Oh yeah, Sean Murphy.
Sean Murphy.
And yeah, it's a little rough, but it's interesting, and
it's a very intentional roughness, but there's kind of a raw cartooniness to it.
But it's a violent crime book, and I would definitely suggest giving that one a look. Then there's a bunch of number 2 issues. Han Solo number 2, very much very fun. Aquaman number 2, Green Lanterns number 2, Vote Loki number 2, Civil War X-Men volume number 2. All those continue on this week. I have read some, but not all of those. Empress gets its 4th issue. Been really digging that so far. Daredevil Punisher gets 3rd issue the week after the second issue came out. So I'm guessing it's a different artist, but I don't actually know. I haven't had a chance to read that one yet. Brian Vaughn and Cliff Chang's uber weird but super cool Paper Girls number 7 continues. And then a couple of graphic novels. There's Level Up, which is written by Gene Lin Wang, who's been doing Superman.
And will certainly be doing the new Superman book, I believe.
Art by Tian Pham, who I don't know. And this is a a kid who his dad dies, and his deep love of video games, he gets kicked out of college, and things get weird. Four adorable but bossy angels, straight out of a sappy greeting card, appear and take charge of his life. He's back on track to become a gastroenterologist, but is he living the life he wants?
That what?
Yeah. They call it a magical realist coming-of-age tale, by turns whimsical and deadly serious.
Interesting. Okay.
So I'm curious. I always love Yang's stuff. He does really interesting stuff. The first collection of Valiant's Faith,
Of breakout heroine.
Yeah. And it's a $10 trade, so, and the ongoing series will be coming, I believe, later this month, or maybe in August.
I have only seen interest in that rise in the last few months. Yeah. So
definitely worth a look. You've been hearing about that. And finally for me, the first of the Star Wars hardcovers, Darth Vader collects all 12 issues of the first 12 issues into a big giant hardcover. I'm sure that we'll get the other 12 in a volume 2, or the other 13, rather, now that we know it's ending at 25.
Yep.
I love these hardcovers. There's two covers, one by Alex Ross, one by, Igor Cordy, whoever does the painty art. The guy does Iron Man all the time.
Artist.
Eddie Granoff does the other one. So, very nice, and if you have not picked up Darth Vader yet, this is a good way to pick it up.
If you have the means, we highly recommend it.
Yes. Dave, what about you?
Did you mention this one, Randy?
I did not.
All right. The DC Rebirth stuff, there's Justice League number one. And that's another, this is the flagship team of the series. I have to say, I was not, wildly looking forward to this one because I wasn't particularly liking the Justice League of America book that they were doing before from the same creative team.
Yeah.
Well, which is to say, Brian Hitch, commonly think of as an artist, had been both writing and drawing that.
Yep.
But I have to say, I kind of like this first one. This is, broadly speaking, it's about a major threat, kaiju-level threat that brings League together. But they are still sort of reeling from the loss of the New 52 Superman.
Right.
And the classic Superman is trying to decide whether he needs to step in or not, whether it's the right thing to do, or whether it's going to make things weird. What his responsibility is. Not to shock people too much, but he is going to end up on this team.
Yeah.
But how it all comes about is pretty interesting. There's some really nice art from Hitch. So I would say people should give that one a look. There's continuing the Batman 66 line. There's a six-part miniseries that's beginning that teams him up with. They can't use the Avengers.
Right.
But this is the British Avengers show from the 60s, which they call now Steed and Mrs. Peel for the comic. So the dryly humorous and dapper spies of the UK meet the Adam West Batman. And it's a fun first issue. The last one I wanted to mention was Mark Crilly, who's done the kids comic Akiko. And also the sort of manga that we really liked, Mickey Falls, and
the one more, the
the Shonen.
I don't remember.
Brody's Ghost.
Thank yes. you.
Has put out a little graphic novel for kids, or at least maybe not even necessarily kids, but kids, teens, called The Drawing Lessons, a graphic novel that teaches you how to draw. And in it, you've got a kid who kind of comes across a lady drawing in the park, who's a talented artist, and he's wishing that he could draw the way she does, and she begins teaching him. But as you watch this kid kind of learn to do art from her, you kind of yourself will be given instructions. She is the voice for the skills and ideas that Mark Crilly himself has picked up over the years. And I only had a chance to read a little bit of it, but it looks really interesting, and I know that Mark Crilly is a good artist, and a good storyteller. So this could be like a notably good book to pick up, especially if you've got younger kids or teens who are looking to get into comics. I imagine this one is definitely one to check out.
Yep. Nick, what else?
I only have one other book, and that's Batman number 2,
yep.
which sees Batman kind of trying to work with Gotham and Gotham Girl against... Solomon Grundy does show up, but there's definitely more at play, and... that's the only other thing on my list.
I will say that had a the variant cover by Tim Sale was particularly beautiful.
Yeah, it really was.
And Randy, I heard you utter a rare compliment to David Finch, the artist.
Yeah, I actually think Finch's art looks pretty good here.
Yeah, I know that you are generally not a big fan, but he has in his way, definitely evolved.
Yeah.
he's not going to abandon his kind of classic 90s, slightly Jim Lee, you know, really muscular characters and stuff.
Well,
like
a lot of people like that style.
Right, right. But yeah. he's refined it, and he's become a better illustrator.
Yeah,
also,
I agree.
Danny Mickey is inking him.
Yeah.
And...
Well, Mickey's not an inker I usually like either. I mean, there's a lot of people on this that I'm like, I'm surprised to be liking it as much as I am.
So, there you have it.
All right. That'll wrap it up for us this week. We don't have any topics to hit, and we ran a little late because of big week reading stuff, so...
We're going to let people go take naps.
Yeah, you all go take naps, and we are going to be back next week. Yo, Joe! Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.